The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin with an article from the books section of the August 5th, 2024 issue of the New Yorker, How Christian Fundamentalism Was Born Again. Nearly a century ago, a single trial seemed to shatter the movement's place in America. It's returned in a new form, but for old reasons. By Michael Luo. It was an age of wonder. Young, free-spirited women in feathery dresses smoked in jazz clubs. Families gathered around big radio cabinets in their living rooms. The marvel of mass production enabled millions of automobiles to roll off assembly lines each year. In the 1920s, modernity was transforming America, ushering in prosperity, polyglot metropolises, and new norms around gender and sexuality. Perhaps most significantly, doubt was creeping into the citadel of religion. A crisis of belief brought on by social and technological change and by growing acceptance of Darwin's theory of evolution threatened Protestant Christianity, the dominant American creed. Fierce fights over the authority of Scripture divided denominations. A backlash was inevitable. The Ku Klux Klan experienced a renaissance, expanding beyond the rural South and into northern cities, the Midwest, and the Pacific Northwest, under the banner of white Protestantism. A loose coalition of Protestant ministers began to style themselves as fundamentalists, defenders of Christian orthodoxy, and foes of modernism. Their aim was to return the nation to God. On January 21, 1925, Representative John Washington Butler, a 49-year-old farmer and clerk for a circle of churches whose members called themselves Primitive Baptists, introduced a bill in the Tennessee legislature that he had written out by hand in front of his fireplace. The Butler Act, as it came to be known, was less than 200 words long. It forbade educators to teach any theory that denies the story of the divine creation of man as taught in the Bible, and to teach instead that man has descended from a lower order of animals. Butler believed evolutionary theory to be dangerous, a threat to the Christian life of our homes. The bill sailed through the legislature and was signed into law on March 21st by Governor Austin P. An official at a nascent organization in New York called the American Civil Liberties Union flagged the law for her boss, and soon a pair of newspapers in Tennessee reported that the organization was seeking a teacher to challenge the statute in court. One of the papers was read by George W. Rapliea, the manager of the Cumberland Coal and Iron Company in Dayton, an isolated town in the eastern part of the state, known for its lush strawberry fields. Dayton had around 2,000 people. There were two drugstores, two blacksmith shops, and a pool hall. Farmers still tied up their horses at the hitching rail on Market Street. Rapliea was a Methodist Sunday school teacher, but he didn't believe that evolution contradicted his faith. He connected the ACLU with John Thomas Scopes, a slender, reserved graduate of the University of Kentucky. Scopes had recently arrived in Dayton to teach math, physics, and chemistry, and to coach the football team. But he also briefly taught biology, using a state-approved textbook that included a short passage on evolution. A deputy sheriff arrested Scopes on a misdemeanor charge of violating the Butler Act. His trial was set for the summer of 1925. The international spectacle that followed is the subject of Keeping the Faith, published by Random House, a briskly told chronicle by Brenda Wineapple, who has a knack for producing popular histories with contemporary resonance. Her previous book, The Impeachers, published in 2019 during the Trump administration, was on the impeachment of President Andrew Johnson. In the preface to Keeping the Faith, Wineapple notes the modern-day parallels to the Scopes Monkey Trial, as it was famously dubbed. Democracy was on trial in Dayton, Wineapple writes, as it would be again in our time. Teachers being told what or how to teach. Science regarded as an out-of-control, godless shibboleth. Books tossed out of schools and libraries. Loyalty oaths and white supremacists promising that a revitalized white Protestant America would lead its citizens out of the slough of moral and spiritual decay to rise again, regardless of what or whose rights and freedoms might be trampled. In recent weeks, conflagrations over the place of religion in American civic life have spread. On June 19th, Louisiana enacted a law that mandated the display of the Ten Commandments in its schools. A week later, Oklahoma State School Superintendent issued a memo requiring that the Bible, which includes the Ten Commandments, be incorporated into curricula, effectively immediately. The central protagonist of Keeping the Faith are Clarence Darrow, the legendary trial lawyer and self-described agnostic who helped defend Scopes, and William Jennings Bryan, a golden-tongued, thrice-failed Democratic presidential candidate who was fundamentalism's flag-bearer. Bryan, in particular, makes for an interesting character study when examined through the prism of today's culture wars. He was a 65-year-old progressive Democrat who inveighed against wealth inequality, advocated for women's suffrage, and championed, as Wineapple writes, the poor, the plain, and anyone left out of an increasingly corporate America. His nickname was the Great Commoner. He was a fervent believer in Christianity's ability to spur people to generosity and compassion. But he also demonstrated the racism that has long been embedded in the American church. Once stating that social equality would throw the white and the black races into greater antagonism and conflict. He joined the prosecution because he felt that the crusade against apism was vital to protecting young minds. We cannot afford to have a system of education that destroys the religious faith of 75% of our children, he said. The prevailing image of the Scopes trial is that of a farcical circus with benighted fundamentalists descending upon Dayton and hanging their banners. Read your Bible. Where will you spend eternity? All over town. Wineapple's rendering of evolution's opposers, however, is notably empathetic. She portrays Bryan as a flawed but earnest defender of democracy, intent on protecting the rights of the states, even if he wanted to make people believe what he believed by decree, if necessary. Scopes' supposedly liberal-minded supporters, Wineapple points out, were closed off in their own way. In their magazine articles and newspaper editorials, these self-appointed arbiters of culture sneered at their Bible-thumping opponents. The two poles did not meet, Wineapple writes. Prejudice encountered prejudice, intolerance, intolerance. The climactic moment of the trial arrived on a Monday afternoon, July 20th, when Scopes' lawyers announced the defense desires to call Mr. Bryan as a witness. It was an audacious maneuver. Darrow's plan was to put the views of a Bible expert, as Bryan described himself, to the test under oath. The confrontation took place in the oppressive summer heat. Earlier in the day, the judge had moved the proceedings onto the courthouse lawn to accommodate the throngs of spectators. Bryan, who sported a bow tie, sat in a wooden chair on a makeshift platform, fanning himself to keep cool. Darrow, slightly stooped, but still ferocious at 68, faced him in shirt sleeves and suspenders. Darrow opened by asking Bryan about his credentials as a Bible scholar, and Bryan said that he'd been studying the Bible for 50 years and that the text should be accepted as it is given. He hastened to point out, however, that there were certain passages that were not meant to be taken literally. For instance, he said, "Ye are the salt of the earth." I would not insist that man was actually salt or that he had flesh of salt, but it is used in the sense of salt as saving God's people. With that, Brian had walked into a trap. Darrow commenced a series of hypotheticals, first querying Brian about the story of Jonah, who was swallowed by a big fish in the Old Testament. "How do you literally interpret that?" Darrow asked. Brian explained that he believed in a God who can make a whale and can make a man and make both do what he pleases. Darrow pressed as to whether this meant that the fish was made especially to swallow a man or not. Brian suggested that it was a miracle. When you get beyond what man can do, you get within the realm of miracles. And it is just as easy to believe the miracle of Jonah as any other miracle in the Bible. Darrow then turned to the passage where Joshua implores God to make the sun stand still so that his army can have more daylight to vanquish the Amorites. Darrow asked Brian if he believed this. Brian affirmed that he did. Slowly but surely, Darrow was guiding his witness into a verbal cul-de-sac. He asked Brian whether he believed that the sun went around the earth at that time. Here, Brian demurred. "No, I believe that the earth goes around the sun." Had he ever considered what would happen if the earth stood still? "Don't you know that it would become a molten mass?" Darrow said. Brian responded that he had never considered this because God would have taken care of whatever needed to happen. "I have been too busy on things that I thought were of more importance than that," he said. Darrow bore down on Brian about the biblical stories of Noah and the flood and the Tower of Babel. Finally, he turned to the creation account in Genesis and asked if Brian believed that the earth was created in 6 literal days. Brian interjected, "Not 6 days or 24 hours, a response that prompted a few gasps from the lawn. Darrow was pleased now. "Doesn't it say so?" Brian said. "No." Tom Stewart, one of the prosecutors, sprang to his feet. "What is the purpose of this examination?" he said. Brian snarled that the only purpose was to cast ridicule on everybody who believes in the Bible. He was sweating profusely. Darrow was livid as well. "We have the purpose of preventing bigots and ignoramuses from controlling the education of the United States, and you know it," he said. Brian proclaimed that he was only trying to protect the Word of God against the greatest atheist or agnostic in the United States. He was standing and screaming, "I want the papers to know I am not afraid to get on the stand in front of him and let him do his worst," he continued. He explained that the 6 days of creation could refer to periods rather than to literal 24-hour days. The belief was not uncommon among evolution's critics. By the time the judge adjourned the court, Brian was disconsolate. The reviews of his performance were brutal. He had come across as intellectually blinkered, hysterical. The following day, however, he got a surprise reprieve. The judge ruled that his testimony was immaterial and struck it from the record. The jury needed only 9 minutes to pronounce Scopes guilty. He was fined $100 for his transgression. 5 days later, Brian took an afternoon nap and never woke up, apparently suffering a stroke. Thousands tuned in to the radio broadcast of his funeral at New York Avenue Presbyterian Church in Washington, D.C. God aimed at Darrow, missed him, and hit Brian, the journalist H.L. Mencken wrote. A year and a half later, the Supreme Court of Tennessee set aside Scope's conviction on a technicality, but upheld the Butler Act's constitutionality. In its decision, the court asserted that Scopes was an employee of the state and therefore subject to its terms of employment. The court also insisted that the law only forbids the teaching of evolution and that nothing contrary to that theory is required to be taught. As a result, the court said the law imposed no religious preference upon public school students. It was not until 4 decades later, in the spring of 1967, that state lawmakers finally repealed the Butler Act. The following year, the Supreme Court of the United States invalidated an anti-evolution statute in Arkansas that dated back to the Scopes era, ruling that the First Amendment mandates government neutrality between religion and religion and between religion and non-religion. The humiliation of the Scopes trial led to the implosion of the Fundamentalist Coalition. Moderate Protestant figures, even those who still held deeply conservative theological beliefs, were no longer willing to be associated with the movement. It seemed on its way to becoming a historical curiosity, a laughingstock born of a particular period of upheaval. The opposite turned out to be true. Wineapple treats fundamentalism's fate after the Scopes trial only glancingly, noting that it would resurface over and over during that century and decidedly during the next. But the story of fundamentalism's near demise, hibernation, and eventually rebirth as a revanchist, militant political force partly underpins the cultural conflict that threatens American democracy today. In 2006, the historian George Marsden issued an updated edition of his classic history, Fundamentalism and American Culture, first published in 1980, which included a new essay on the birth of the religious right and its roots in the fundamentalism of the 1920s. Marsden describes how the earlier movement was steeped in the revivalist tradition of American Christianity, which prioritized evangelism and personal piety. By the 1950s, a new evangelical movement had emerged, led by Billy Graham and other prominent figures such as Harold Alkinga, the pastor of the Congregationalist Park Street Church in Boston, and Carl F. H. Henry, a theologian at Fuller Theological Seminary outside Los Angeles. These men wanted to forge a more intellectually respectable, culturally engaged movement than their fundamentalist forebears had, one that would allow them to regain a foothold in American life. They succeeded, attracting believers from a broad spectrum of theological and even political commitments, mainline Protestants, Pentecostals, Reformed, and others. The largest contingent, however, comprised those whose religious lineages could be traced directly back to fundamentalism. A separatist fringe of conservative Protestants also continued to self-identify as fundamentalists, building their own institutions in defiance of Graham and the broader evangelical movement. Marsden's conclusion is that the religious right, which emerged in the aftermath of the cultural turbulence of the 60s and early 70s, ultimately drew upon both these separatist fundamentalists and evangelicals who were fundamentalistic in their outlook. In many ways, today's America resembles the tumultuous one in which the Scopes trial unfolded. The religious landscape is, once again, undergoing precipitous change. According to the Pew Research Center, the number of Americans who identify as Christian plunged from 9 out of 10 in the early 1990s to less than two-thirds in 2020. Once again, norms around gender and sexuality are rapidly evolving. A notable difference is that liberal mainline Protestant denominations have dwindled in number and influence. The modernist threat within the church, theological liberalism, has largely faded as a concern among fundamentalist Christians. Instead, their energies and alarm have shifted almost entirely to the political realm. Marsden attributes this both to the resourcefulness of evangelical leaders who realize that political influence could bolster their movement and to the shrewdness of Republican politicians who saw a voting bloc that could be co-opted for their own purposes. In recent years, a raft of books have been published by authors decrying the evangelical movement's alliance with right-wing politics, its vulnerability to racism, its unseemly blending of God and country, and particularly its obeisance to Donald Trump. Many of these books are by people who consider themselves to be part of that movement. If evangelicals are like sheep, theirs is the bleeding from the edge of the flock. in Losing Our Religion, published in 2023, Russell Moore, the editor-in-chief of Christianity Today, who, in 2021, resigned as the head of the public policy arm of the Southern Baptist Convention, argues that the current exodus from American churches is different from the crisis of belief in the 1920s. We see now young evangelicals walking away from evangelicalism, not because they do not believe what the church teaches, but because they believe the church itself does not believe what the church teaches, he writes. Moore and other dismayed evangelicals, including David French, a columnist for the New York Times, and Curtis Chang, the executive director of a Christian nonprofit, recently launched a video course called The After Party, Toward Better Christian Politics. An accompanying book written by Chang and Nancy French, who is married to David and has ghostwritten for conservative politicians, sets out the course's animating idea, encouraging evangelicals to be less preoccupied with the what of politics and more concerned with the how, focusing on spiritual values such as love, forgiveness, and mercy, with a particular emphasis on hope and humility. This big shift, Chang and French write, is necessary to prevent a broader, catastrophic loss of our democracy. The book collects stories from the organizers of The After Party about their own journeys of conscience in politics. David French is a former litigator for Christian conservative causes. He admits that he was a combatant in the culture wars. In 2007, he spoke at a conservative convention and identified far-left radicals at home and jihadists abroad as the two greatest threats facing America. Later that year, French deployed to Iraq as a military lawyer. One of his roommates was a liberal Mexican-American army captain who told French he belonged to the Church of the Hubble Telescope because he believed only in what he could see. The two men spent hours sparring, like Darrow and Brian, debating religion, politics, and other subjects. "We didn't change each other," French says. "He didn't become like me, and I didn't become like him. But he was my first friend in Iraq." French says that his roommate helped him begin to see his political opponents as neighbors. Today he remains anti-abortion, but he's also a prominent Never Trump Republican and has been outspoken about racial disparities in policing. "Time and again, the more I learned, the more I regretted my previous combativeness," he says. "I was trying hard to win arguments, when I now realize I wasn't even right." The authors of The After Party remind believers that reconciliation to God inherently leads to reconciliation with others. They encourage Christians to draw on the resources of their faith to model a more relational, less tribal approach to politics. It's a stirring admonition. But Wineapple's observation about the tragedy of the Scopes trial is that both sides failed to see the other. The self-appointed arbiters of culture can seem just as contemptuous of faith as they were a century ago, even as their own beliefs become an altar unto themselves. The divide may very well be unbridgeable, but Marsden suggests that both sides keep in mind the wide angle of history and what it reveals, that cultural conflicts are not simply products of the machinations of the warped minds of one's opponents, but rather reflect deeply embedded cultural patterns. A clear-eyed explanation of fundamentalism's resilience might include a recognition from non-believers that there is something wanting in the secular consensus, a lacuna that scientific, technological, and social progress has failed to address. The values of humility and hope could benefit us all. Next, from the under review section of the July 31st, 2024 online edition of The New Yorker, "Are you an artist? The creative life is shrouded in mystery. Two new books try to discover what it takes. by Alexandra Schwartz. Louise Bourgeois loved to work, and she loved to talk. She especially loved to talk about her work. In the 2008 documentary, Louise Bourgeois, The Spider, The Mistress, and The Tangerine, directed by Marion Cajori and Ami Wallach, you can watch the whole thing on YouTube. Isn't that great? She answers questions as she chisels and draws and violently wrings scraps of material as a butcher might wring a chicken's neck. "It is really the anger that makes me work," she says. She has just been discussing her governess, the despised Sadie, an English woman who carried on an affair with Bourgeois' father for 10 years while she lived in the family home. "All my work of the last 50 years, all my subjects, have found their inspiration in my childhood," Bourgeois adds. She is an old woman when she says this, wrinkled, commanding, vital. And also, it seems, forever a little girl peeping through the keyhole at Sadie and Papa, shocked and betrayed. In another video, one that has found new life bopping around TikTok and Instagram, Bourgeois sits at a small table in her Chelsea townhouse before a blank piece of paper. "This drawing that I'm going to do now obviously stems from a fear," she says. "Anger, fear, these are the powerful horses that Bourgeois harnessed to make her art, and she rode them until she died in 2010 at the age of 98. How do artists sustain themselves year after year, through good times and bad? What special fuel do they use to stoke their inner hearths? This is the subject of The Long Run, A Creative Inquiry, published by Grey Wolf, a new book by the writer Stacey D'Erasmo. Originally, D'Erasmo tells us her approach to the project was detached, a little academic. She was getting older. She's now 62, and thought that she would publish an anthology of interviews with veteran artists who could give a view of the road ahead. Then she had a crisis, or a series of them, both personal and professional. "Relationships broke, friendships broke, promises broke," she writes. "Many facets of my identity shattered." She was denied tenure at Columbia, where she had taught for a decade, and suddenly found herself out of a job. After a lifetime spent loving women and joyously enrolled in the queer world, she coupled off with a man. Worst of all, she found that, for the first time in her working life, she was totally unable to write. "How do we keep doing this, this making art?" she asks in her book's first sentence. She really wants to know. Well, define your we. The one that D'Erasmo has gathered here is a cohort of 8 artists who have little in common aside from living long, creatively productive lives. There is the dancer Valda Setterfield, who performed with Merce Cunningham and went on to enjoy a decades-long collaboration with her husband, the choreographer David Gordon. The writer Samuel R. Delaney, who has published more than 40 books and seems to write as he breathes, and also the pioneering landscape architect Daryl Morrison, who takes the natural world for his material. The actress Blair Brown has struggled, as many actresses do, with an industry that tends to see young women as the sum of their body's parts and to stop seeing older ones at all, while the abstract painter Amy Sillman experienced a creative breakthrough in her late 50s. The composer and conductor Tanya Leon was born in Cuba but made her career in exile, while the musician Steve Earle, a veteran of drugs, divorce, and death, seems to be on his 4th or 5th life, trucking on with his guitar. So D'Erasmo was gutsy. She hopped among genres. She didn't stick to what she knew, and she's upfront about that. When, for example, she feels intimidated by Leon's music, she comes right out and says so. "I am not a gardener," she confesses in her chapter on Morrison, but in a way, she is. Like Morrison, who pioneered the concept of sweeps, in which a variety of native plants are grouped in swaths and clusters and handfuls to create something at once organic and spectacular. D'Erasmo plants her subjects together in unexpected arrangements, throwing in some favorite seeds of her own. A reference to Colette or Roberto Bolaño here, a look at Asawa's sculptures there, and then steps back to see what patterns emerge. One big thing that D'Erasmo discovers her subjects have in common is their flexibility, the ability to change along with circumstances. A vibrant long run might be sustained not by armoring oneself inside an even bigger and more expensive fixed narrative, but by morphing through a varied series of them over many years, she writes in her chapter on Brown. Against the monument, the mobile, against the hammer, the leap. She means that it's okay that Brown has never become a megastar in the Marvel universe or whatever. That although she has played many wonderful, meaty roles over the course of her career, sometimes her phone just doesn't ring. Acting is different from painting or writing or composing. You can't do it alone. You have to work with what you're given. Brown is now 78 and hasn't had a television or film role since a four-season arc on Orange is the New Black ended in 2019. Still, she seems happy. Not long ago, she turned down a Yes Dear role as someone's wife on an HBO show because it felt too limiting. She has, D'Erasmo thinks, admiringly, an inner freedom. In her chapter on Silman, D'Erasmo doubles down on the flexibility point. Artistic survival, she says, is fundamentally Darwinian. Long-term success requires adapting to the environment at hand. For D'Erasmo, that means the American University, where so many artists and writers today make their living. D'Erasmo reserves a righteous anger for the precarity of academia, which she experienced firsthand, and for its increasingly corporate donor-flattering imperatives. But she also seems to genuinely like her students, as do many of her subjects. Delaney, who projects a prickly, detached persona when asked to discuss his own work, tears up while speaking about teaching. Silman does him one better. When she was on the faculty at Bard, she says she considered not only her teaching work, but indeed her job as a department co-chair as part of her actual art practice. This sounds both noble and nuts. Did Wallace Stevens think of insurance law as part of his poetry? But it makes a kind of sense. You're going to have to serve somebody, Bob Dylan saying, and this is what D'Erasmo thinks, too. Michelangelo had to be able to deal with the Pope, which often did not go well, she writes. Artists and writers working now have to be able to deal with the Dean, which also often does not go well. Michelangelo may have had it worse. Imagine the Dean telling you that you have to paint the ceiling. At the same time, artists need steel at their core, some essential private self to return to after the department meetings are over and class is let out. You make your living where you can, while, in D'Erasmo's phrase, cultivating the deep stamina of the double agent, working first and last for yourself. Doubleness intrigues her. Two of her subjects, Morrison and Delaney, came out as gay after marriages to women. Delaney's wife, the wonderful poet Marilyn Hacker, came out too. And D'Erasmo thinks that this personal liberation also liberated their work. Morrison began thinking in terms of music and color. It was as if, freed from a certain vector of secrecy, his capacity for synesthesia opened up. This is a romantic idea. Art as a kind of triumph of the true self over the homogenizing pressures of social convention. And it is as appealing now as it was 200 years ago. But what if the self doesn't just burst shining through the clouds? What if it actually changes? When Durasmo was in her 40s, she discovered that she was attracted to men. This led to the paradoxical shock of finding herself once again closeted, afraid that admitting her private feelings would constitute a betrayal of the community that had meant so much to her. But the self may be more malleable than we think, and so is community. For years, Durasmo belonged to a chosen family of mostly queer New York writers and performers. When she describes this time in her life, the page glows. Its disillusion was like a weather event, not attributable to any single cause, and it left a lonely void. There is a lot of writing here about breakups, both platonic and romantic. You get the sense that Durasmo hopes art itself can be a kind of lover to her, one that never has to leave. The question of stamina comes up in another recent book on artists, The Work of Art by Adam Moss. Like Durasmo, Moss wants to understand what makes artists tick, and he goes about it in a pragmatic, proudly anti-romantic way. "My curiosity is earthbound," he tells us. "No meaning, no magic." His subtitle, "How Something Comes from Nothing," announces where his emphasis is. He treats art works as a mechanically minded kid might treat a dismantled tape deck, poking and prodding at their insides to figure out how all those jangled parts make a whole. The Rasmus book is a companionable 157 pages. It is best read in a sitting or two. Moss's runs to more than 400 pages and is designed to be absorbed in bursts of pleasure. His sample size is bigger, too. The substance of his book is 43 richly illustrated interviews, case studies, he calls them, that he conducted with artists of all kinds, among them the architect Elizabeth Diller, the dancer Twyla Tharp, the writers Sheila Hetty, Tony Kushner, and Gay Talese, the poets Louise Gluck and Marie Howe, the filmmaker Sofia Coppola, the showrunners David Mandel and David Simon, and the artists Susan Mieselis, Cheryl Pope, Kara Walker, and Amy Silman, the only overlap with Durasmo, in which they each describe how a single work of theirs came to be. Moss has fun stretching his definition of art as far as it can go. A piece of meat, he thinks, can be one when it is the centerpiece of a dish cooked by the chefs Jody Williams and Rita Sodi at their Manhattan restaurant Via Carota. So can a newspaper's front page, like the one that the New York Times ran in May 2020 to commemorate those who died from COVID. Moss is not known as an artist, but as an editor, most recently of New York Magazine. But he admits at the start of his book, he is an artist, a painter. "I feel ridiculous saying that," he says, and you can understand why. He has not been painting for a long time, only since leaving New York, which he did in 2019. "I got frustrated easily and gave up easily," he tells us of his early attempts. Nevertheless, he persisted, and it is that quality that earns him the right to the title. Of all the traits that he came to see as uniting the artists he spoke with, discipline, focus, curiosity, patience. The most important, he says, is endurance. "Each of the subjects was a dog with a bone," he writes. Beneath that relentlessness, he sees something else, faith, the bedrock confidence that you can actually do what you are trying to do. It is faith, in fact, that may be the irreducible unit of creation, the atom of the artistic self. Durasmo writes that when Silman was in her 30s, her mother suggested she go to law school. "What's the worst case scenario?" Silman thought. "I'm not a famous artist, so what? Does that mean that they can tell me I'm not an artist?" No, they cannot tell me that. Louise Bourgeois made work for years without showing it. "My favorite formulation of the condition comes from Saul Bellow in A Metaphor of Profane Audacity. you pour the oil on your own head, and then you keep pouring it over and over again. You shampoo. Maybe the practical and the mystical sides of art making aren't at such odds. I was amazed to learn in The Work of Art that Kara Walker's astonishing sculpture, A Subtlety or the Marvelous Sugar Baby, a massive Sphinx figure that was installed in 2014 at the old Domino Sugar Refinery in Williamsburg, had its origins in a PowerPoint presentation that Walker made to the arts organization that was sponsoring the work. It's hard to get less romantic than Microsoft Office. Meanwhile, the revelation that the sculpture should be made from sugar came to Walker not in some quiet moment of private contemplation, but while reading on the Q train. And it is comforting to hear poet Louise Gluck tell Moss that she regularly gets frustrated when I have no idea what to do next. What do you do in that moment to help yourself? Moss asks. I just wait, Gluck says. At the end of the waiting, something happens. Working prepares the artist for the discovery, and discovery sustains their work. When D'Erasmo was going through her big midlife sexuality crisis, she realized that she had a choice. She could try to stay the same for the sake of her sense of herself, not unimportant, or she could follow her desire path, a term in landscape architecture that describes an unplanned route that people make for themselves to take them where they want to go. This is what she ended up doing, because that is what artists do. In the lives of the people I interviewed, and in my own life, will is certainly a factor, she writes. However, of equal, if not greater importance, is willingness. Moss says that he wanted to examine moments of creation in order to render them less and yet more miraculous at the same time. Talk about contradiction. When you read these books, you may feel that the art you are confronting becomes at once more and less knowable. It's a good, life-giving feeling that you can look as long and hard as you want, and still some mystery remains. And now, the daily comment from the July 31st, 2024 online edition of The New Yorker. It's too early to give up on homelessness in America. The country's most powerful deep blue governor, Gavin Newsom, ordered encampments to be dismantled. But lasting solutions are still needed. By Nathan Heller. California has 71,000 shelter beds to serve a homeless population estimated at 180,000. By basic measures, that isn't the worst housing crisis in America. The state with the highest rate of homelessness is New York, followed by Vermont. But it means that California is the state where urban homelessness is most consistently visible, often as encampments, much in the way that utility poles are visible where cables are not buried underground. People with housing space need utility connections, and people without housing space need places to exist and sleep. Since 1967, Californians have invested in underground pathways for the grid, on the theory that being shaded by poles, wires, and other essentials is incompatible with the state's promise of golden landscapes and good living, and much less safe in a storm. You can now walk through many California cities, scarcely spotting a utility pole. Homelessness is different. In surveys over several years, voters have named homelessness and housing as the state's most pressing problems, but a visible crisis of space remains. If all unhoused Californians sought a night's emergency shelter, less than half of them could get it. Late last week, California's Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom issued an executive order for officials to start dismantling homeless encampments on state land. The order followed a U.S. Supreme Court decision in June City of Grants Pass, Oregon versus Johnson, which upheld that city's ban on homeless residents sleeping outdoors, a case that Newsom had pressed the court to take up. It is presumed to supersede Martin versus the City of Boise, a Ninth Circuit decision from 2018 that made it illegal to punish homeless people for camping if shelter beds were not available. Newsom, who is the country's most powerful deep blue governor by virtue of his state's economic dynamism and his rising status within his party, has become one of the nation's most active leaders in the fight against homelessness. And he presented his order in the terms of left-of-center concern. This executive order directs state agencies to move urgently to address dangerous encampments while supporting and assisting the individuals living in them, he said. He modeled his directive on the California Department of Transportation's protocols for clearing encampments away from freeways. The order traveled better than its pieties. I'm warming up the bulldozer. I want the tents away from the residential areas and the shopping centers and the freeways, R. Rex Paris, the Republican mayor of Lancaster, a small Southern California city that consists almost entirely of residential areas, shopping centers, and freeways, told the New York Times. Across the partisan channel, London Breed, the mayor of San Francisco, who is seeking re-election in an incumbency weighed down partly by accounts of street homelessness and open drug use in the city, told the press, "My hope is that we can clear them all." The idea that leaders bulldozing tents and the poor people who live in them out of sight is now considered a winning political strategy might reveal the Swiftian level to which much social thinking has fallen. It is worth noting, then, that the project promises little success on its own terms. The governor's order, which amounts to uprooting encampments and their residents, supporting and assisting them through contact with outreach services, and most often sending them to something other than shelter or housing, is fated to be an expensive and labor-intensive project in reshuffling and buck-passing in the face of a problem that has seemed too hard for too long. The basic wish of the program, like many in America right now, is, please, just make these people disappear. But with no permanent solution available, homeless people driven from the north side of town land on the south side, still homeless. Chase them from a city, and they find themselves in the next town. A few years ago, I undertook a months-long reported study of homelessness in San Francisco for the magazine. As I spoke with dozens of unhoused people, along with service providers, politicians, and community leaders, some of the most unsettling accounts I heard concerned displacements of camps. One young man dealt with upping and moving his life among tent encampments marked for clearance. Dispersals are supposed to be announced in advance, while attending community college. Since unhoused people often carry everything they have with them, belongings that are removed can be an outsized loss. Officially, these belongings are supposed to be impounded, like a towed car, in street parlance, bagged and tagged. But the administrative burden of bagging and tagging is great, and one homeless person told me that, in practice, possessions were not infrequently classified as abandoned and then swept into the trash. I heard accounts of lost identity documents, family heirlooms and photographs, and medicines for HIV. One woman described a friend going through the formal recovery process for her belongings, including a trip to a remote holding site without ever being reunited with them. In studies, encampment dispersals, or sweeps, have repeatedly been shown to not just be ineffective, for the simple reason that people move from here, land there, but to exacerbate homelessness's ill social effects. No one, or almost no one, dreams of living an adult life from a tent. But for many homeless people, it can seem like the most tenable bad option. Some unhoused people, with whom I spoke, deliberately avoided shelters, which could mean trying to sleep beside a disturbed stranger screaming in the night. Shelters could also mean bedbugs, personal theft, and the looming threat of physical or sexual assault on one hand, and infantilizing rules on the other. The hostel from hell. Some required residents to be drug-free at admission, a policy with obvious appeal, but hardly a feat that can be achieved on the threshold. Even substance abusers in well-resourced lives work long and hard toward sobriety. Some shelters, too, didn't allow animals, and for a person whose only devoted confidant in a life of instability is, say, a dog, abandoning this one friend for temporary access to a bed can seem an unthinkable exchange. There is nothing like a sole or easy solution to the problem of housing the unhoused. But clearing encampments without anything like a requisite number of shelter or housing options subtracts space for the existence of the state's neediest residents at both ends. Studies in California disprove the common false claim that homeless people travel to inflict their homelessness on distant, innocent communities. Migrants, relocated by governors in southern states aside, the vast majority become homeless in the place where they were last housed. The mayor there is their mayor, the governor, their governor. The city, even if they have no dwelling there, their home. These locals are not interlopers of the place, but products of it as much as anybody else. California is the country's most prosperous and economically productive state, with a mean household income of $130,000. Its median household income is approximately a third less than that, and its Gini value for income distribution, a measure of inequality, is well above the national value and rising, indicating that prosperity flows disproportionately to the economic top. Housing, too. California's housing prices are, on average, the highest in the nation. Yet, a quarter of its residents are said to be living with severe housing problems, a measure of unaffordability or lack of basic amenities. The rise in living costs in California, as in many other thriving states, has wildly outpaced growth in structures of access to available housing, generative income, and other basic measures of stability that make it possible for many people to keep up with and enjoy that prosperity. In San Francisco, whose housing shortage is notorious, the median rent for a studio apartment is currently $2,000 a month. Several of the homeless people I met were working full-time jobs and still could not find their way back into housed life. An air of exhaustion surrounds the American homeless problem, and rightly so. Over the years, Newsom's state has, in good faith, tried plausible-seeming solutions, including adding billions of dollars in new funds for health and housing programs, all without overwhelming success. A national election of unprecedented importance looms. The presidential candidate now endowed with the task of preserving American democracy is a Californian and vulnerable to attack as a proxy for the state. But it is too early to give up. California's problems are increasingly the nation's problems. New York City, which used to hold enough shelter beds for its homeless population, no longer does so, in the wake of migrants bused there from the South. And progress is being made. In June, Los Angeles announced a 10% decrease in street homelessness compared with the previous year, the first double-digit decline in nearly a decade, and a testament, perhaps, to the efforts by its mayor, Karen Bass, to use motel housing for those who would otherwise live in tents. Last week, Bass came out in opposition to the governor's encampment order. The Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors this week passed a defiant motion preventing people in encampments from being taken to county jails. In my reporting, I found evidence of remarkable success through Advanced Housing First programs, nonprofits that set up unhoused people in subsidized apartments with professional counselors and health resources to help them get back on their feet and gradually take over payment of their rents. Such solutions take time to work. Unhoused people are said to bounce out of housing situations several times before the problems in their lives, which tend to be complex and tangled, start to comb out, and they get back into the rhythms of a self-supporting life. But it does happen, and with time and smart spending, the best solutions, which involve multi-pronged counseling and persistence, do last. Looking out for the health, well-being, and the opportunities of the entire community is not a troublesome chore that people, their governments, and their enterprises get saddled with on the way to sealing deals for the office towers. It is, or ought to be, the proudest work of a first world society. This country at the moment isn't out in front. In a pinch, it has become clear, Americans will do the utmost to preserve our majestic landscapes. We should feel the same pride looking out across our population, too. Finally, a poem from the August 5th, 2024 edition of The New Yorker, Sighting, by Jacqueline Ushereau. There it was, hogging a huge swath of street, twice as long as the Civic Park beside it, relic of the jaunty middle century into which lucky you and I were born, when no one thought of limits to Earth's bounty, white with red leather upholstery, red instrument panel, red steering wheel, a fend preening Cadillac Seville, top down, as if to lure me in. I half thought you would show up with the key. If anything could have brought you home, it would have been that swank, outlandish car. Were you still alive then? I'm not sure, but I know I waited. You didn't come. We've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.